case for argument is United States v. Boister. Ms. Haas?
May it please the Court. Elizabeth Haas, appearing on behalf of Appellant Timothy Boister. The issue in this case is whether a single mailing made by one Indiana state office to another in May 2001 was sufficient to support a conviction for mail fraud when that fraud had reached fruition more than a year earlier.
When you say it reached fruition, was the scheme still operating when that last mailing was made?
The goal of the scheme was to charge for services not rendered to the state of Indiana. The proceeds had been collected as of April of 2001. So when this mailing occurred on May 25th, 2001, the scheme was over.
They had been fully paid?
They had been paid for the services.
How long had it been over?
It was April of 2000 is when the last check was issued to Mr. Boister's employer for the work performed on this site. The mailing occurred May 25th, 2001. It's 11 months, or 13 months.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry. I have a little factual, I guess, question. How would vacating Boister's conviction on count one assist him? Aren't his convictions on count one and count two running concurrently?
Yes. Mr. Boister is serving concurrent sentences for 60 months in prison. However, the restitution from count one and count two is very different because of the two different schemes involved in count one and count two. Under count one, there's roughly $330,000 of restitution that Mr. Boister owes, whereas under count two, he only owes approximately $160,000.
So the whole thing is about the money.
Yes. There'd be a significant reduction in the amount of restitution.
What do you think was the purpose of this last mailing?
The purpose of this mailing was to complete the P&A report, which is an administrative document that the Indiana DNR uses when plugging and closing wells. It was sent in for the sole purpose of releasing the bond.
Yeah, I know, but why did they do that? Having pocketed their ill-gotten gains, why did they bother to fill out this form?
Because as part of the well closing process, the form had to be completed.
What do you mean the form had to be completed? They have the money. Why do they have to complete the form?
Well, there's no evidence in the record to suggest that had they not completed the form, that the DNR would have been...
So that's my question. Why did they bother to complete the form?
Mr. Veach, who worked for the DNR, I can only guess, completed it as part of his performing his duties for the DNR.
So what if they completed the form because they wanted to make sure they kept the money? They didn't get... Right? Suppose the scheme was to get these reimbursements and to keep them, and that the mailing was to further the keeping part of the scheme.
The mailing really did nothing to further the keeping of the scheme. The proceeds had been paid well before. And
why didn't the mailing keep it quiet? I mean, the fact is, as Judge Posner says, having gotten the money, you know, they could have moved to the Cayman Islands or something. They could have gotten away and kept the money and not bothered with this administrative formality in the bond release. Who cares? But by going through the final formalities, maybe they opened up the possibility of further schemes. Maybe they facilitated concealment of this scheme by appearing with this last set of documents, all consistent with the earlier documents that were fraudulent, facilitated concealment of the scheme.
Well, under the Indiana regulations for filling out these P&A reports, they're supposed to be finished. That second certification on the P&A report should be finished within 6 months of the plugging activity. This was not finished for a year and a half later, so 1 year beyond the statutory limitations or the limitations
but
period.
That actually just further mystifies things because, again, you know, they could have just not done it, but instead they keep their activities going in a way by having this final mailing. And I guess, I don't know, does the record show how many people are late with these bond release forms?
There's nothing in the record to say that this sort of delay is normal or acceptable.
I mean, the state may not care. I mean, they're holding the money, right? So they may figure that normal incentives are good enough to assure timely filings most of the time.
The fact that the mailing was so late and had, I mean, is so separate from the purpose and intent of the scheme to defraud the state for money shows that it can't be in furtherance of the scheme.
Why? I mean, I don't know that that the inferences that you're drawing have to be drawn. If by having a nice, perfect close to this record allows them to escape the attention of auditors of the state of Indiana or other unwelcome attention, such as from U.S. attorneys, why doesn't this final document really, you know, tie it off with a bow?
Well, the document can't conceal the fraud because there's no possibility that the document could reveal the fraud.
But it makes it look like it's a legitimate scheme. That's what the concern is.
You know, you cited the our Brocksmith opinion. And in it, we said use of the mails to lull victims into a false sense of security violates the mail fraud statute, even if it occurs after the money has been fraudulently obtained. So why wouldn't that be similar, that by completing this paperwork, they avoid arousing suspicions?
The P&A report, as it was used in this instance, was only to release the bond on the well. The goal of the scheme was to obtain the funds from the state of Indiana. So the use of the P&A report here has nothing to do, it's not a step in the plot to obtain the funds from Indiana. That had already occurred.
That's not the point. It's the lulling the victims into a false sense of security by completing the paperwork. These people, the defendants, wouldn't have liked, or the client, wouldn't have liked the Department of National Resources to come after them and say, hey, what about your form? You know?
But there's no evidence in the records to suggest that they would have come after him.
You still haven't given any reason why, other than lulling the victims, why the defendant would have bothered with this form.
I mean, do you think the scheme would have gone unnoticed if the P&A reports were never completed? Is that your view?
It's unclear from the record how the scheme was detected and whether it would have gone unnoticed.
I mean, wouldn't it be, as has been noted, the necessary final step in the scheme as a whole?
The goal of the scheme was to obtain the proceeds, and since that had happened so long before, this was just an ancillary mailing.
Then why did they fill out why did they mail the form?
I don't know.
Who received the bond when it was released?
It's not clear from the record.
I know.
It says in the record.
And how was the fraud ultimately discovered? That's not even clear from the
record. That's not clear in the record either. Only that.
So the form. Was the form false?
The form did state that these.
So they went to the bother of submitting a false. Probably that's a separate crime of some sort. So why would they do that? The only hypothesis I can think of is to, you know, lull the victims into a false sense of security. No other possible reason.
The form cannot.
You can imagine someone who submits a truthful form is attack of conscience or something. But to submit a fraudulent form, that has to be connected with the fraud, right? Not a new fraud, because there's nothing to be gained by it. New, just part of the old fraud.
There is some connection, but that connection is ancillary at best.
So what? What does ancillary mean, anyway?
In order for a mailing to support the mail fraud conviction, the mailing needs to be incident to an essential purpose of the scheme.
So what does that say? How is ancillary? Isn't ancillary incident? What's the difference?
I would say that ancillary is too far removed.
That's just a word, ancillary. What does that mean?
It's not in support of the fraud.
It is in support of the fraud because there's no other reason except to support the fraud why they would submit this fraudulent form.
The goal of the fraud was to obtain the proceeds, and that had happened.
So then why did they, having completed their fraud, why did they submit another fraudulent document?
The P&A report is a three-part form. It has three certifications on it. The initial use of the P&A report, the first certification, was to state that these bridge plugs had been used in the wells when, in fact, they had not. And that was in order to obtain the payment for the services not rendered on the wells. That's how the P&A report was used to further the scheme. the use of the P&A report here, a mailing between two state government offices, has nothing to do with their scheme.
Well, wait, look. Given the evidence that the reports were a required final step in the process, couldn't a jury infer that the falsified reports assisted in covering up the scheme and so were incidental to the more central mission of the scheme, namely defrauding IDEM into paying Bostrer's firm for work it did not do, regardless of whether they'd been paid before?
It is our position that the mailings could not conceal the fraud because there was no way that they could reveal the fraud. And the fact that they, you know, in the alternative, the fact that they were mailed so far beyond the regulation period could not, you know, should have perhaps alerted the DNR to the problem with these wells.
Could your client have been prosecuted for mail fraud, for a separate offense of mail fraud for that fraudulent mailing?
He was not charged with that, and if he was,
could he have been? Is that mail fraud too?
The mailing of the bond letter. Theoretically, he could have been charged with that, but we would argue that that mailing would not be in furtherance of the scheme to defraud.
It would be a separate mail fraud.
It would be separate, but I think the facts would show that that would not support a conviction for mail fraud.
Why not?
Because it is wholly removed from the scheme to defraud the state to obtain the proceeds.
So what would it be? Is that a crime to fraudulently advise? I understand. Surely the cover-up can be charged as a separate mail fraud, right?
If there's a mailing after the fact that conceals the fraud, that can support a mailing, the mailing element for a conviction of mail fraud.
No, you're not getting the point. There are two, it seems to me under the best of your argument, there are two mail frauds. There's the initial one to get the money, and then there's the cover-up mail fraud, the mailing of this false P&A.
But the only mailing that fell within the statute of limitations was the mailing between the two.
So he could have been prosecuted for a separate mail fraud, right?
For the mailing that occurred earlier to obtain the permit?
No,
the later one, the P&A one.
Right? That's mail fraud, too.
Our position is no, that he could not, because that mailing would not be in furtherance of the scheme to defraud.
It's a new scheme.
Don't you understand?
He gets a bond out of it. He lies and he gets money from.
He doesn't get the money.
His group does, his scheme.
No, from the evidence in the record, it seems to suggest that the state had.
You think that mail fraud that the use of mails to cover up a fraud is not actionable?
When there's a use of mails that does not further the scheme to defraud. It cannot support
understand.
A conviction for mail fraud.
I don't understand. Suppose they complete a fraud, and 10 years later, with the FBI on their tails, they make a bunch of fraudulent mailings designed to conceal that earlier fraud. Statute of limitations has long run on the earlier fraud. But now they're prosecuted for a separate mail fraud, the current mailings designed to cover up an earlier fraud. And are you suggesting that this second set of mailings is not itself actionable as mail fraud?
The government could have brought a claim of mail fraud against the schemers for that mailing, but it did not.
Okay, well, thank you. So we agree on that. Thank you, Ms. Haas. So, Mr. DeBroda?
May it please the court, counsel. This appeal is about Exhibits 5A and 5B.
But you're treading on a fine line, too, aren't you? Because a cover-up of a fraud is not necessarily part of the original fraud. But usually it's not, right?
Yes, usually not.
Right.
But
so what's special here?
Well, let's take a step back. These are not simply to cover up the fraud. These are part of the fraud.
Why is that taking a step back? I'm asking you why this is part of the original fraud rather than a cover-up.
Okay, it's part of the original fraud because when you look at Exhibits 5A and 5B, these documents are signed by Donald Veach, one of the three perpetrators. He was the DNR inspector on the project. His official action in certifying that the work was done in the way that's described here was certifying that the work was done in a way that was fraudulent. These documents are fraudulent, and the government proved that overwhelmingly at trial. There's no real argument about that. What he's done here is he's taken an official action on behalf of DNR that was designed to convince DNR and the other four agencies that were involved that the work was done in compliance with the terms of the Claremark Oil contract or the agreement that was testified about.
14 months after they've been paid, though, isn't it?
Yeah, but that's not, there's no evidence to suggest there's anything wrong with that in the slightest. And there is evidence in the record explaining why there was a delay.
Wrong and right. I don't see how that enters into it, but what do you mean by nothing wrong?
Well, they suggest that after 6 months, something magical happens. But the evidence in the record explained by Donald Veach and why there was a delay is quite simple. What happens in the 14 months from when they complete the below-ground work, and the middle portion of this form is about the below-ground work primarily, they then have to clean out the equipment that's on top of an oil well, like the pumps and a lot of other things. They simply, in this project, didn't complete the above-ground work, as Donald Veach testified specifically, until this time period when he goes out there on May 25 of 2001.
What evidence was there that if Veach and Hanisch had truthfully completed the P&A report, the discrepancy between the report and the invoices would have ever been discovered by the Department of Natural Resources?
If they had filled the form out correctly, a series of cascading events would have happened. Okay. First off, this form shows a cast iron bridge plug was put in each of the wells in question, and we're talking about two of the wells. There's no such plug in there. The billing for that is part of the fraud that Tim Boister did through his company.
So a correct form would have said, in fact, part two of this form is inaccurate?
A correctly filled out form could not have shown, as it does, that a cast iron bridge plug is in there. That's in the second portion. In the third portion, it says the inspector, again, Donald Veach, has to report that the work was done in the way described accurately in the form, and it wasn't done that way. It wasn't done as it's described. So what he's done is he's actually the inspector. The third step of the process is when it gets to Indianapolis. At that point, the person up there is deciding to take final official agency action on the well closure itself. The well closure is not done yet until the top is completed. And at that point, DNR loses its ability to go against the $30,000 bond to fix any potential problems. And in this case, that's quite critical because there's a lot of problems in this case. These wells aren't closed correctly, and they had to be redrilled, and that's the basis of the restitution. And six of them were redrilled, and this is in the record, at great cost to the agencies involved. So what you've got is you've got a situation where the scheme as conceived by the people doing it, Veach, Hanisch, and Boister, and Veach and Hanisch specifically testified to this, included the submission of these forms. So that's why I said in response to Judge Posner's question, the scheme from the beginning does not end with a receipt of money. The scheme was far broader than that. This was a scheme to convince the four agencies involved, and what's important here principally is IDEM and DNR, that the wells were closed in compliance with the contract. Now, testimony from Harry Atkinson, the IDEM person, said that the filing of P&A reports was an implied condition of the contract. And that's why these had to be filed. And their effect was, if they had not been filed, then the wells never would have been closed as far as one of the state of Indiana agencies was concerned.
So bottom line, your argument is that the P&A reports were a necessary project and a necessary final step in the overall project, even though payment was not contingent on the P&A reports. So that's why the P&A reports are connected to the fraud as a whole.
That's true, but let me add a clarification. If these P&A reports had never been filed, if the schemers had taken the money and gone to the Caribbean, what happens eventually is the well closures are never completed. The Department of Natural Resources can't certify that they've been completed. They still hold their bond. IDEM, the official agency, was working directly with DNR on this project, and there's a lot of testimony in that in the record. These four agencies were working closely together in this project. And as the IDEM agency witness testified, he would have been informed of this and he would have started asking questions.
That's not a good argument, because if they had run off to the Caribbean in, you know, April 2000, that would suggest the scheme was complete and that any further activities after that would be a separate cover-up.
It wouldn't be complete as to Donald Veach, who wanted to keep his job at IDEM, or to
DNR. Sure, but what about Boyster, right? If he runs off to Caribbean or Cuba or something like that?
Well, he's got a lot of reasons, but each of the three working together designed this scheme, and they all have independent reasons to keep everything secret.
No, but look, you're pushing too hard, because now you're saying there's no end to a scheme to defraud. There's no end. Any kind of cover-up would just be they had reasons to cover up, right? 20 years later.
I'm not arguing that.
Sniffing around, and they say, oh, we have reasons.
No,
what you're not arguing. What's the distinction you're drawing?
Well, first we have to start with observing that this is contract fraud. Overbilling on a contract that required completion of the contract.
If these people take their money in April 2000 and run, why isn't the natural inference that's the end of the scheme? They're off in some place where we don't have an extradition treaty, right?
That would be the end of the scheme, and it would fail. But if they choose to have subsequent mailings, the scheme is still going on during the subsequent mailings.
See what the problem is. All right, now they're off in some country that doesn't have an extradition treaty with the United States. And then 20 years later, they decide, well, they might want to come back to the United States. So now they send additional mailings designed to hide what they had done. And now your argument is, well, that's all part of the original scheme.
No, I'm not arguing that. In the context of your question, that's more like what you suggested in the Bond situation. It's a separate fraud scheme now to hide the existence of the first whose statute of limitations has run. That's another way of going about it. What we alleged and proved here, though, was that it was continuous. And that's what the witnesses testified to.
So you're relying, if I understand you correctly, on the fact that this above-ground work needed to be finished and that it was sort of in direct temporal sequence thereafter that this form is filed. They do the below-ground work, then they do the above-ground work, then the form is filed?
In substance, in order for the inspector to sign the bottom portion of the report, all of the above-ground work must be completed at that time.
And when was that? What was the date?
Donald Veach testified about the delay. Why was there a delay between when the middle portion and the bottom portion is filled out? And he said, as he recalled, they hadn't completed the above-ground work yet. Now, the Bayou Creek project and Claremark Oil project total 53-some wells, and the second part of it, the Bayou Creek project, 23 wells. That was a lot of area to clean up, a lot of testimony about this at trial. If they could have done it sooner, it would have clearly been in their benefit, but they couldn't falsely certify the above-ground work was done when it wasn't, because it would be patently obvious that it wasn't done.
So that's the reason that the report went to the Evansville office a year and a half after the well was plugged and 6 months after the one-year deadline given in the Indiana Code?
The reason what Donald Veach does is he completes the middle and bottom portion, then he turns that in at the Evansville office.
Right.
Yes. And he testified that he turned it in roughly when the date is here.
So, but that's a year and a half late.
No, there's nothing in the record to show that that's late or that the lateness would matter in any way at all.
So even though the Indiana Code gives you a one-year deadline, you can send it in 6 months late?
That's the question that the defense didn't ask at trial. And there's a distinction today between what they want to do reading the code and reasoning from it versus what happened at trial. The guy from DNR who testified about this didn't seem troubled, and on his testimony wasn't troubled, by this delay, apart from noting that it's over the time limit. But he went ahead after this form was completed, and he doesn't know it's fraudulent, and releases the bonds. So they accepted this form in its fraudulent state in Indianapolis after the agency approval. So it doesn't matter that there's a six-month violation that could have started an enforcement action or not. That doesn't make any difference at all. What matters is the scheme included the submission of these documents, and both as a part of the scheme and as a cover-up. It's both. And that process wasn't completed until all the forms were in. That's our position, Your Honor.
That's really interesting, because my thought when I was reading it was that the lateness undercut your theory that these fellows were particularly concerned that every portion of the project, including the P&A reports, be completed properly so as to avoid detection. Because my thought would be, you know, if you're a year and a half late on one thing and you're 6 months late on another, bells start ringing. But I guess not.
Huh? My time's expired. Can I answer that question,
Your Honor? I would be grateful.
Sure. They have a problem, Your Honor, in that they're not very good at this either.
Okay.
And getting the above ground work completed was something that was a condition precedent to getting these forms filed. It would have been very silly for them to file these forms while still having pump jacks and equipment up above ground. So once Carl Hanisch and Tim Boyster and those folks get everything completed above ground, by the way, which they made money on as well, that's when they could complete the form.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks,
Mr. DeBroda. Ms. Haas, how much time does she... You don't have any time, but you can have a minute if you have something further you'd like to say.
I'd just like to address one point made about the use of the P&A reports. Here, the P&A reports were used to state that this plug had been placed in the well when, in fact, it had not. That P&A report was then used to create an invoice for this plug that was sent on to the state. The goal from the beginning was to get proceeds from the state for services not rendered. In order to reveal the fraud, the P&A report would need to be compared to this invoice. A P&A report on its face does not distinguish whether it's fraudulent or not. You need to look at the invoice for the work on the well and to look at the P&A report to see if there's a discrepancy. However, that comparison process never occurs because the P&A reports go to the DNR and the invoices go to the item. There was testimony at trial by a DNR employee saying that he had never seen an invoice for this work until he testified at trial. That means that the P&A report cannot be in concealment of the scheme to defraud. The other issue that I want to address quickly is that when a mailing could possibly reveal the fraud or works against the fraud, it cannot provide the mailing element for a mail fraud conviction. As was just stated by counsel, this form was completed 6 months or a year beyond the regulation period. That means that it cannot be used in furtherance of the scheme to defraud if it wasn't pursuant to the regulations that covered the closing of the well.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Haas. And you were appointed, were you not? So we thank you for your efforts on behalf of your client. And we thank Mr. DeBroda also. And the court will be in recess until 9:30 tomorrow.